Today is the 10th of December, and we're continuing in Yechezkel. We are in Perek Chaf Gimel, chapter 23. And last time, we got a little sidetracked, where we talked about the tragedy in India towards the end of last time's learning. So we didn't finish quite to where I wanted to get to last time. So we were kind of in the middle of the discussion, and we were up to Pasuk Chaf Hei, 25. Now, if you'll recall from last time, was anybody not here last week? I think everybody here was here last week, too. Okay. So, if you'll recall from last time, Yechezkel described the two kingdoms, the southern kingdom and the northern kingdom. The northern kingdom was described as Ahala, and the southern kingdom is Ahaliva. And we explained why last time. And he went through, using a mashal, but he went through how the northern kingdom did things wrong and ended up getting taken into Galus, and how the southern kingdom, instead of learning the lesson from the northern kingdom, did the same thing and continued in their ways. And therefore, they also have to be punished. And that we were discussing really part of the punishment that was going on when we started discussing last week about India. So, if you'll remember that Yechezkel is using as his mashal, as his parable, he's using an unfaithful wife. But the truth is, that's not really what is being described. What's really being described is, who remembers? Which Avera?
Avodah Zarah.
Because us not being faithful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and going to a foreign god, that's akin to a woman not being faithful to her husband. So that's why that's the mashal that is used. And as we saw, he was very graphic about it. I didn't even translate literally some of the psukim. We saw that his descriptive way of presenting this mashal. Now, there was something which, there was a loose end last time which I wanted to cover, and let's start with that this evening before we start Pasuk Chafei. And that is that the mashal that he used, the graphic description that Yechezkel used, he was very, very specific about parts of the body, and the part of the body that he constantly was referring to was how the foreign men or the foreign nations, depending on how you use the mashal, were involved in the part of the body that a woman feeds her baby. And that was the constant reference. So the question I have for you, which we should answer this evening, is why is that the mashal? He could have really chosen any part of the body. If he had to be descriptive, it could have been any part of the body. Why focus on that? If you want to see where he uses that description, so the first place is, let's see, is back in Pasuk Ches, verse 8. And then again, let's see, there's another one here. Yeah, then again in Chafav 21. And tonight we're going to have another reference to it. So what's important to understand is that you know that if you want to know how different parts of the body are used by the Nevi'im, the best place to look is in Shir HaShirim, in Song of Songs. Because in Shir HaShirim, which is a descriptive love story between a man and a woman, but as we know, Shlomo HaMelech wrote that really as a love story between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and us, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the man and we are the woman. And the way that everything is described there, and the mashal that's used, so every aspect of the body, the head, the eyes, the neck, everything means something else. And so there, the dadim, are the way that Chazal say it is that they are referring to Moshe and Aaron. That in the Midbar, in the wilderness, Moshe and Aaron were the Shaddayim. Why is that? Why would Moshe and Aaron be compared to the Shaddayim of a woman? Why should that be so?
They nurtured the people.
Okay, they nurtured the people. Because we just as a mother nurtures her child, so there is the leadership of the Bnei Yisrael, particularly Moshe and Aaron, nurtured the people. Moshe with the Torah and Aaron with either the Avodah or the Shalom, depending on which aspect of Aaron you choose to focus on. The Shaddayim are always used to be a parable for the for nurturing and also for the Mesorah, for the tradition, going from one generation to the next. Because there's no more intense way that a parent gives over to a child than through nursing. And so there, that's always a mashal for the nurturing and for the Mesorah, for the passing on of the tradition from one generation to the next. So what is being said over here is that Klal Yisrael, when they went to first Ashur and to Mitzrayim and other nations, they were, so to speak, usurping the Shaddayim. That they should have been nurtured, they should have been allowing themselves to be nurtured from their leadership, from the Torah leaders, and from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, from the Nevi'im, from the prophets. And instead, they were giving over that part of their body, which would imply that which gives over to the next generation, they were giving that over to foreign nations. Which is if you think about it, it's far more terrible than anything else. Because it's one thing if I decide, God forbid, to go off and go to another nation. But it's much worse if I condemn my children to it. And that's what it means. If they're giving over the Shaddayim, it means they're giving over the next generation, not just themselves, but they're giving over their future to the foreign nations. That's what's being implied over here. And that's why it's so terrible.
I don't know. Are you saying that the tribes were teaching Torah to other nations? Or?
No. But it says that they were allowing themselves to be molested. They weren't really molested, it was consensual. But they were allowing themselves to be used by these other nations. That's the way it's described. So the idea is that the focus is on that part of the body because they were giving themselves over, not just themselves, but they were even giving over their ability to give to the next generation.
What does that mean? They were giving this, or they were doing idol work?
Yeah, that's what it's like.
So they were promiscuous.
They were. It's a mashal. It's a parable. They were actually worshipping idols.
But isn't that always connected with?
Yeah, with promiscuity. Correct.
Promiscuity.
Right. But the point is that they weren't just doing it themselves. They were giving it over to the next generation. They were encouraging their children to do it. They were giving their children over to the foreign nations. Everything should be, you know, the school system reflected it. Whatever, you know, I don't mean, there was no school system there, but you understand what I'm trying to say. That it was meant to be something which would carry over to the next generation. It wasn't just this generation did something wrong. You frequently have a situation where a parent can do something wrong, but still say, but I don't want my child to be like that. You know, it may be good enough for me, but it's not good for my child. My child has to be better than me. And very often a parent is far more strict with their child than with themselves, which is in itself a problem. But that notion is very common, that even if I'm not so careful, but I'm going to make sure my children are. I remember once talking to a rabbi in another community many years ago about a certain couple, and I was asking this rabbi, this couple had just moved into to this rabbi's community, and I was asking this rabbi about trying to bring this couple closer to Torah and show them about Shabbos, etc. And he said to me, it's not going to work right now. Right now they're wrapped up in their own lives and they're having a good time, and it's right now all we can do is just stay friendly with them. However, wait till they have children. Then you'll see. And his words were prophetic. once they had children, and those children reached school age, then of course they wanted to send their kids to a good Jewish school. And of course they wanted the children to come to Shul on Shabbos. Well, if the children are going to come to Shul on Shabbos, so does the father, and then the mother. And then, you know, and then of course they want the children to eat kosher, so they had a kosher in their home. Like the whole, it all was because, well, we care because our children. Well, they themselves were not acting that way for many years, but he understood that once they had children, it would be far more ready to change their lives. And that's what Yechezkel is pointing out over here, is that wasn't happening. That which is a very natural tendency here was not happening. Here they were willing even to lose their children. And that's why it was so terrible. So we continue with Pasuk Chafei 25. V'nasati kin asi bach, I will place my kina, which literally means my jealousy, but here it means the punishment, his anger. V'asach b'chema, they will do to you with anger. They, the nations that you went to, are now going to gonna hurt you with anger. Apech v'aznayech yasiru, your nose and your ears they will remove. V'acharisech b'cherev tipol, and whatever is left after you will fall by the sword. Hema b'anayech v'nosayech yikachu, they will take your sons and your daughters. V'acharisech t'yachel v'esh, and whatever is left will be burned in fire. The analogy here of that they will remove your nose and your ears, which is obviously barbaric, but the Mefarshim say that it was the custom in some nations that the way that they would punish a woman who was unfaithful was to disfigure her face. And that was what they would do. And so that's what is being said over here as a mashal. However, the deeper meaning is that Chazal tell us that the nose and the ears represent, the nose represents malchus, royalty, and the ears represent kuhuna, the priesthood. Hashem says, when you are cast into galus, you're going to lose both royalty and the kuhuna and the priesthood. Now, that doesn't mean we lost the people. We still have malchus based David. We have the line. We don't know who they are, but we certainly do have the line of David HaMelech. And as we know, we have Kohanim. But it means we've lost their functioning ability. Obviously the kings don't do anything anymore. And the Kohanim, although they get the first Aliyah, that's about it. And they Duchen. But they don't. Certainly we don't have the base of English for them to do the Avodah in.
Why those body parts remain?
Okay, so that's the first question. Why those body parts? Why would the nose be royalty, be the Malchus? And why would the ears be the kahuna? Now, before we answer that question, let's think a little bit more over here. That's two of the three pronged crown of the Bnei Yisrael. What's the third one? What's that?
Torah.
Right? We have Malchus, we have kahuna, and we have Torah. Those are the three kesarim, the three crowns. Now, we know that we kept the crown of Torah. That has never been lost and will never be lost. That's not going to be taken away. When Hashem cast us into Golos, we lost the two that are a family business. We lost the Malchus and we lost the Kahuna. But Torah, which is open to all, that we did not lose. And we need it to keep it. Otherwise, we would have nothing to hold us together. That's it. The Torah is all that keeps us right now. So, which part of the body then, or I should say, which part of the face then represents Torah? If the nose is Malchus, and the ears are Kahuna, the eyes. Right? The eyes, you would think, is Torah. The only thing you have left is the mouth. But it's going to be one of the two. So, that makes a lot of sense, that the eyes are Torah. As the Pasuk says in Parashas Vayikra, when talking about the different types of karbanos that are brought, when the leadership does a sin. The psukim over there talk about a sin offering, a chatas. And the sin offering for a regular person would be one type. But then if it's the leadership that do an avera, then they have to bring a special type of karban. So there's one that applies to the king, there's one that applies to the Kohen Gadol, and there's one that applies to the Sanhedrin, the high court, which is the leadership of Torah. For the Sanhedrin, that's all talking about sins by mistake. You don't bring a carbon for sins on purpose. It's for sins that are done by mistake. So if the Sanhedrin paskins incorrectly, and most of the Bnei Yisrael act on their ruling, and unfortunately everybody does it wrong because they ruled wrong, and then they discover their mistake, they have to bring a special carbon. So the way the Torah introduces that is, im me'enei ha'eda ne'esesa v'shkaga, if from the eyes of the congregation it was done by mistake. So the eyes refer to the Sanhedrin. Yeah.
Why couldn't it be that the eyes are the written law and the mouth is the oral
law? It could be. It's both. You're right. It could be. I'm just showing from that pasuk that the eyes are the Sanhedrin. Now the mouth would also be, we also have references of course to the mouth and Torah, because they you speak Torah. I mean, that's the way that you deal with Torah, as you speak it. So we have that as well. So the nose, the Mefarshim say, refers to the king, because the nose is considered to be the high point of the face. Now, even though the eyes may be a little bit higher up than the nose, but when you look at a person's face, the nose is what you see. That's the thing that really defines the face.
Also, because the nose is like the sensor of
okay.
the person.
Okay, good, good. So explain that. Say that a little further. And why should it be the king?
I can't remember which Navi it is. It says somewhere, Zehebricho B'tzedekah.
Good, excellent. So the Navi says in Yeshaya, referring to the Melech HaMashiach,
yeah.
in the future, when the king, who will be Mashiach, when he comes, it says, Ve'irichu, he'll be able to smell who's right and who's wrong. You know, he say, oh, you know, I smell a rat, you know. But literally, he'll be able to, his nose will be so sensitive, he'll be able to pick up who is the liar and who's the cheat, based on his nose. The Gemara says that of all the senses, the one that is closest to ruchnius, closest to spirituality, is the nose, is smell. That's the one that's closest to spirituality. And the Mashiach will have that special connection that he'll be able to discern things based on smell. I once read that the sense that triggers memory the best is the sense of smell. More than sight or hearing or touch, the sense of smell is the one that triggers memory most.
Also, Yitzchak smelled Gan Eden.
That's right, Yitzchak smelled Gan Eden. The other thing about the nose is that we know what is the king. The king is the leader. And what is the greatest challenge for the king? What is the king of all challenges? What is the king's main challenge as he is a king? What's that?
To unify, to keep justice.
That's his job. That's his job. But what's his...
Keep from pride?
Keep from pride. The most serious danger a king has is to lose himself in his own power.
Yep,
oh, right. So your nose in the air, right? That's not just an expression. That's not just an expression. It's really true, right? You walk around like holier than thou, right? That's the struggle the king always has. That's why he has to carry a Sefer Torah with him all the time. To remind himself that he's not above the law. He's there to direct everybody to the law, but he's not above the law.
And what do we do as simple people? I mean, that's the way. What do we do? What are we supposed to do?
To keep ourselves from feeling over. So we have to do whatever we can. But we don't have the same struggle that a king has. Mm-hmm. A king really has that struggle. Mm-hmm. So the nose represents the king. The ears represent the kahuna. They represent the priesthood. The way the Mefarshim say it is because we know that one of the things the Kohen Gadol has to wear, the bells. That's right. And it says in the pasuk, "V'nishma kolo," his sound will be heard whenever he comes into the Beis HaMikdash. The bells will attach to his me'il, to his jacket, and it's an obligation. He has to wear that, and he has to make noise as he walks. It's an interesting thing. The Kohen Gadol could not. He couldn't sneak in. You know, he's late, right? Couldn't sneak in or sneak out. He was a very public figure.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I think about it, I think to myself, I would never want to be like that. It would be that you wouldn't be able to have privacy when you're at the as you're wearing the the clothing. When you're wearing the clothing, you are, you're a public figure. Everywhere you move, the bells ring.
But that's trying to help them remember, like the animals, because most cows have the bells or something so they can be kept track of. I mean, back nowadays, you probably have sensors. But you know, so you're sensitive to those that you're about to slaughter. You
okay.
have to feel that same feeling.
Okay.
That they feel.
That's interesting. It's interesting. It's interesting.
It's basically for Lashon Hara, wasn't it?
Well, that was part of it. Part of it was for Lashon Hara, right? To be Mechaper for Lashon Hara.
So wasn't there also something about the bells that they were supposed to keep evil?
Well,
it was
a kapara. It was an atonement. When he wore his clothing, each article of clothing atoned for something else. So
this was
atoned as Mrs. Zagman said, for Lashon Hara, as it made noise.
Uh-huh.
So it was to atone for that. So that's what the Mefarshim say. So the sense of hearing is connected to the Kohen Gadol. Can we attach the sense of hearing to Kahuna in another way? We think of another way where the sense of hearing or sound is connected to.
Okay, they
call shofar. Good, good. Good, good. Say a little more sharply. You're right.
Internalized, sort of. When you hear something, you're understanding something.
Okay, you're understanding something.
Do they teach the people more, or?
They do teach, but what is the Kohen's main job?
The avoda.
What is the avoda?
Pray.
It's davening. Davening is sound. Davening is sound. You can davening in your mind is not davening. A person who can't speak, the only thing they can do is think the davening. But if a person can speak, they must say the words. To simply think the words is not davening. You have to actually say the words. Even Shemona Esrei, which we say very quietly that no one else should hear us saying it, but we do need to say the words. Tefillah is to actually say the words. It has to be sound that comes out. Otherwise, it's not considered.
Does it lead to a dialogue with Hashem in the sense you're having to pray and you're going to receive it back? So you're hearing also, it's like a two-way stream.
That's correct. That's correct.
So one way, his praying, right?
That's correct.
Did he wear this 24/7?
No.
Not when he's sleeping, but
no.
Only in the ceremonies?
He did it when he was in the Beis HaMikdash.
Mm-hmm. What was he doing when he wasn't there?
The Kohen Gadol? I don't know.
I mean, was it like a lot of hours mostly in there?
Yeah, he was mostly in the Beis HaMikdash. He did a lot of time in there. A regular Kohen only worked 2 weeks a year. There were 24 shifts. They each took a week.
They rotated.
Right. But the Kohen Gadol was very heavy, labor intensive. Yeah.
So what, did you get to listen to the Levian that were singing while they
were sure.
So they were listening.
Yeah, okay.
Well, the Levian would sing as the Kohanim are working.
Yeah, that is true,
so
too.
They would hear. They were 3 steps. The 13th step, the Shammah.
15th.
You have to guide
the
people, too, right?
Okay. Okay.
Let me ask a question that's way off. That I've, when they waved of the priest, did they really physically pick them up? Or the animals?
Whatever whatever had to be waved, they actually picked up, yeah. But usually it wasn't the whole animal. Usually it was pieces. You know, it was the shoulder or whatever.
What about when they put the new priest in?
No, only then. In Parashas Baaloscha, when the Levium were made into Levium, Aaron had to wave all of them.
He actually lifted them all
yeah.
in or Moshe?
Yeah.
But Moshe lifted them.
I think it was Aaron, but I don't remember. I think it was Aaron. But anyway... Yeah, that's what happened. That was one of the that was an incredible thing. So now let's think this through. So we have the three crowns, and let's assume that we have it correct, that the king would be the nose, and the Kohen would be the ears, and the Torah is the eyes. So Hashem says to the Jewish people, you're going to be cast into Galus without your nose or your ears. You're going to lose the Malchus, and you're going to lose the Kahuna. But you'll keep your eyes. You'll keep the Torah. A person who does not have a nose, it certainly is a disfigurement. He looks bad, but does he function? Can that person function? Person can certainly function without their nose. It may not be a very enjoyable life, because I would imagine it affects the sense of taste and all of that. The person may look very
weird,
ugly, right? It may look funny and disfigured, and certainly would not be spoken of as a beautiful person, but the person can function. It doesn't ruin their ability to function. But a person doesn't have ears, so that's much more difficult to function. The Gemara says that a cheresh, someone who is deaf, is considered like a shaita, is considered like someone who is dumb, who is impaired, mentally impaired. Now, the Gemara is talking about someone who is deaf from birth, and there's a whole discussion whether, with today's breakthroughs in how to educate the deaf, that perhaps things are a little bit different today. But I believe that studies show that someone who is deaf from birth is always at a disadvantage to someone who was deaf, who was hearing and then became deaf. Even Helen Keller started her life being able to see and to hear. The fact that she was later educated, but until she was two, she was able to see and hear both. It was a sickness that took it away from her. If a person is born without those abilities, without the ability to hear, it's a much more difficult process, and I don't know whether studies show that they can reach the level of education of someone who had been able to hear and then lost it. Be that as it may, the Gemara likens the two in a legal sense. It's not a judgmental thing, it's a legal thing. The question is, can the person make acquisitions? Can the person be a shliach? Can they be an agent of somebody else? All these different things, because the communication is very, very difficult. So the cheresh is considered like a shaita, someone who lacks knowledge. So that's much more difficult to function, but they're still functioning. They're still around. A suma, someone who is, God forbid, blind, what does the Gemara consider a blind person like? Chashuv is considered kemes, like someone who is dead. Someone who is blind is considered legally like someone who is no longer around. The Pasuk tells us that the reason why Hashem was willing to call himself Elokei Yitzchak, the God of Yitzchak, which he never does while a person is still alive. He never said Elokei Avraham, the God of Avraham, as long as Avraham was alive. Only after Avraham died. Because the Pasuk says, Heim b'kadosh av lo yamin. Hashem doesn't trust in his holy ones. A person may be very, very great, but at the very last minute of his life, he could go off and do something wrong.
Can you see where that's from?
Heim b'kadosh av lo yamin?
Yeah.
That's a Pasuk. That's correct. Hein b'kadosh av lo yamin is a pasuk. I don't remember where.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I don't remember where.
Right.
So so only after Avram died, but Yitzchak, even while he was still alive, Hashem refers to him as Elokei Yitzchak, and I'm the God of Yitzchak. So Rashi explains in the name of Chazal, because Yitzchak was blind, and once he was blind, he was considered like he was dead, which means, obviously he was alive, he was living, he was breathing. It's not that his life was worthless, but it means that he's not in the living anymore. He's really in the next world already. The chances of him going off the derech became very, very unlikely. A blind person doesn't have the temptations of someone who can see, doesn't have the mobility of someone who can see, just doesn't have, is not really involved in the world anymore. And it seems to me that that's part of what's going on here as well. Hashem is saying, Yechezkel is saying, that when you go into Galus, you're going to lose your nose and your ears, which are both terrible things to lose, but you're going to keep your eyes. Because if you lose your eyes, then you're no longer living. So we have to keep the Torah. The Torah we can't have it taken away from us. The Jews without Torah are as good as dead. The Jews without Malchus and Kahuna have a very difficult time functioning, but we're not dead.
Well, I'm losing it here. It's usually if a person's blind, their hearing and their sense of you know, taste and everything is enhanced.
Correct.
But with us, without our ears and nose, so to speak, we're not enhanced with our Torah knowledge.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, that sense of seeing, a sight, has not improved.
Right.
I don't know. Meaning, it's not certainly not improved above where it was before we went into Golus. However, we don't know if it's improved over where we would be if we had Kahuna and Malchus. As there is no question that the focus of Klal Yisrael over the past 2,000 years has been Torah, because we don't have anything else to focus on. There is nothing else. I mean, the level of scholarship that we have produced over the past 2,000 years has been incredible. Mm-hmm. So I don't know whether it's better or worse than what would have been. But I can say with certainty that we certainly are focused on that, because we have nothing else to focus on.
What about the land of Israel?
That's a very recent phenomenon, that we have that back.
Right, but wasn't that always a focus to take it, to somehow get it back?
Yeah, but we didn't have it. We certainly couldn't use it in any way. Now that's ultimately the most basic part of Golus, is to not be in Eretz Yisrael. The challenge today is to remember that even though when a person is in Eretz Yisrael, they're still in Golus. Mm-hmm. That's the challenge. Because a person could mistakenly believe, I'm on the land. But the land is a far cry from what it's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. So we are technically still in Golus. Chavav 26. V'im shituches begadayach, and he will remove your clothing, v'lakhu klei sifarteich, and take your utensils of glory. The clothing here refers to the clothing of the Kohanim, and the utensils of glory refer to the utensils of the Beis HaMikdash. V'yishpati zimaseich mimeich, and I will remove your lewdness from you. You'll no longer be able to do that. V'yishpati zimaseich meretz Mitzrayim, and your adulterous ways from the lands of Mitzrayim. V'losisi einayich aleihem, you will no longer lift your eyes to them. U'mitzrayim losis kiriot, you will no longer mention Mitzrayim. Kichomar Hashem Elokim, for so says Hashem God. Hinani no snuch biyad asher sones. I'm going to place you in the hands of those who you hated. Biyad asher nok anaf sheikh mehem, in the hands of those that you removed your soul from them. Which was the, if you recall from last week, that was the custom, the Babylonians, that originally the Jews had turned to and then tried to pull away from. And now Hashem says, I'm going to give you over to them. They will do to you with hatred. They will take all that you toiled over. And they will leave you completely unclothed without anything. And your shame will be revealed. And your lewdness and your adulterous ways. Now this phrase, Vazavuch Eirom ve'eryah, they will leave you completely naked. Eirom ve'eryah, we had before, and we say it at the Seder night. We had it before, and that was back, I think it was Perek Tezayin, chapter 16. This, if you remember the mashal that Yechezkel said about the young girl who had nothing, she was left, mm-hmm. and she was rolling in the mud and in blood, and she had nothing, mm-hmm. and then the man came along and helped her. Mm-hmm. So there it says, which we say at a bris, b'damai chayi, b'damai chayi. Mm-hmm. So what we quote on the Seder night,
naked and bare is verse 39 in chapter 16.
Is that where it is?
Well, you said 16, and I said
Yeah.
Naked and bare. That might be a different place than you have in mind.
A couple days off.
You're right. It's in Lama Tess and 39. That's not the one we quote in the Seder. Is that the one we quote in the Seder? No, and it's there also. Good. We have quoted a lot. But there's one that we quote in the Seder, which is Pasuk. It's Pasuk Zayin, Pasuk 7. You'll remember it from the Seder, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
Right? This is that we had nothing. Which means we had no mitzvos. That's the analogy over here. Completely unclothed means we had no mitzvos. He says, "I found you, and you've at erom ve'ariyah. You had nothing." So this pasuk we quote in the Seder in Magid. Rivavah ketzemach hasadeh nesatich.
What does that mean? We had no mitzvah. I mean, all along we had, still had
Kohen.
They didn't use the service.
In Mitzrayim, in Egypt, before we were redeemed from Egypt, back before we got the Torah. So Hashem says, "I saw you had no mitzvah." So He gave us the mitzvahs of.
Before.
He gave us two mitzvahs that involve blood. He gave us Mila, mm-hmm. Bris Mila, and He gave us the Karban Pesach. And that's b'damayich chayi, b'damayich chayi. You'll live with your blood, you'll live with your blood.
It's confusing. Number 27, Hashem says He's going to abolish our lewdness in the harlotry, take it away from us.
Right.
But then, after that is the punishment. I mean, how does He purify us and then punish us?
Well, no, it's purifying us here means He's going to take away from us the ability to sin by removing us from the non-Jews.
Oh, just physically.
Yeah, that we have no ability to sin anymore because they don't love us anymore. The non-Jews are going to hate us, and then we can't sin anymore. But the punishment still has to come.
It's His choice to do that, not ours.
Right, correct. Correct. So, so over here, with where it's quoted also in Perek Chof Gimel 23, Aaron ve'Ariyah, completely naked. I saw Rabbi Eisman wants to suggest that this means a complete reversal, going back to the way you were before I found you in Egypt. Because I found you in Egypt and I took care of you and all that, and now I'm going to put you back into that state of being completely without anything. Lamed Pasuk, Lamed 30. So Eile Loch, this will be done to you, Biznusech Acharei Goyim, because you went after the Goyim, Arashen Yitmeis Begiluleim, because you became impure with their abominations. B'derech Achosei Halach, you went in the ways of your sister, which means Ahaliva, the northern kingdom. V'nasati Chosa B'yadech, and I will place her cup, this is that cup of calamity, I will now place that her cup in your hands.
Also Sota, cup of the Sota?
It could be a reference to that as well. It could be referenced to that as well. But the Kos Shalparanius, that's what it's referring to over here, that cup of calamity. And Hashem goes on to say, just one second. Yeah. Kolamar Hashem Elokim, says Hashem God. Kos Achoseich Tishti, the cup of your sister you will drink. Ha'amukha V'harechava, it is deep and it is wide. It's a very large cup. There's a lot of calamity in there. You will be tzchok and lag means teasing and disdain. People will make fun of you more than can be held. More than can be described. Shikaron v'yago. Now, what the Navi is doing over here is comparing that cup to a cup of wine. And that she'll be forced to drink this wine, but it's not wine that gets her, makes her happy. It's wine that brings destruction.
Who's the sister?
The sister was the northern kingdom.
Northern kingdom.
Right. Was Ahalah. Shikaron viagon timalei. You'll be filled with drunkenness and sorrow. Kos shama ushama. A cup of desolation. Kos achosech shomron. The cup of your sister Shomron. Vishasis osa, you will drink it. Umatsis. Matsis means to suck on it. It's, the analogy is someone who is trying to get as much alcohol as they can, and they finished the drink, and they're trying to get whatever they can out of that cup. But then the pasuk says, Ves charaseha tigaremi, and its shards you will... you'll also try to get as much out of the shards as possible. It'll be smashed.
What are shards?
Shards. The pieces of the cup. The cup will be smashed into pieces. Vishadayich tenateki. Again, the reference to shadayim. They will be removed. Ki ani dibarti, for I have spoken. Um Hashem Elokim, says Hashem God. I'll explain this in a moment. Let's read one more pasuk, which is as far as we're going to go tonight. Lachain klamar Hashem Elokim. Therefore, so says Hashem God. Yan shachacht osi, since you forgot me. Vatashlichi osi acharei gaveich, and you threw me after your body. Vagam at siizi masech ves taznu sayich. Therefore, you'll have to carry your lewdness and your adulterous ways, which means you'll have to deal with the punishment for those things. And we have to explain these two psukim, and that's how we'll conclude with this evening. The Rashi explains that the cup, the kos of Peronius, the kos atar elah, the kos of calamity, is drunk here by the Jewish people. We are being forced to drink it. This analogy that was used many times throughout the Nevi'im, we will see later, it is used for other nations to drink it. It's foreshadowing their own destruction. What is very important to note is that with the Jews, it is a cup of, that it has shards. Now, a cup that has shards means it's an earthenware cup. It's a kli cheres, a cup made out of pottery. When it's a cup that is given to the other nations, it is always a cup of gold or other metals. Now there's a major difference between a kli cheres, a cup made of pottery, or utensil made out of pottery, and a kli matchus, and a cup made out of metal. And that is that we know that the rules of Tuma and Tara are different between the two. With metal kalim, they can be taken to a mikveh, and then they can be purified. If your metal kalim becomes tameh, you can take it to the mikveh. I'm not talking about when you buy a kli taking it to the mikveh. When you buy a knife or buy a spoon or a fork, that's true also. But I'm not talking about that here. I'm talking about here in the time of the Beis Hamikdash, when you wanted your utensils to be tahar, if your metal kalim became tameh, what do? You take it to the mikvah. If your kli cheres, your pottery kli became tameh, what do?
Smashes.
Can't do anything with it. You can't make it tar. Now, the Gemara tells us that glass is similar to a kli cheres in one respect, similar to pottery in one respect, and it's similar to clay matchus, it's similar to metal in another respect. And therefore the laws of glass tend to straddle the fence. So how are they like pottery? They're like pottery because glass comes from the sand, just like pottery comes from dirt. So in that respect it's like pottery. On the other hand, the Gemara says it's like metal, because metal, if a metal kli is broken and you can't fix it, you can take the metal, melt it down, and make a new kli out of it. Glass as well, if you have shards of glass, you can melt down the glass and make new utensils out of that glass. But pottery, once it's broken, it has no use. It cannot be reconstituted. There's no such thing as melting down pottery. Once it's broken down, it's finished. The kos, this cup of destruction that we have to drink, is always made out of pottery, which means it's something which, after it's finished, what do you do with it after it's finished? You smash it, and it's finished, and it's not drunk from again. Which implies that although we unfortunately have to go through calamity, it will end.
How many cups are there?
It's deep and it's wide.
Yeah, but that's every one cup. But when that cup's done, it's done. So, like, are there a limited amount of these earthenware cups of calamity?
There's only, I mean, this one, we only have one being described over here. This is.
We're still suffering from it.
Yeah. But unlike the cup of the other nations of the world, which is a metal cup, it can never be destroyed. Even when they finish it and they want to destroy it and they'll smash it, it can always be made into something else, made into another cup. So the analogy is, or the nimshal is, that the puranios that we get, the destruction or the calamity we get, is only meant to be something that will bring us back to where we're supposed to be. while the other nations of the world, once they have reached their threshold, then Hashem does away with them. It's a difference between the way Hashem deals with us and deals with them.
It's also interesting because if it's gold or silver, then their calamity might be wealth or respect or something like that, or earthenware, it's like you become humbled.
Okay, that's good. It's misleading. There seems to be something nice, something good. It may look good at first. When it says, by the way, in Lamed Aleph 34, v'shadayach tenak teki, that your shadayim will be removed, it doesn't mean literally removed, it means the way that you were dealing with your shadayim earlier, as we described in the beginning of tonight's shir, that which was inappropriate, that will be removed. You'll no longer misuse the shadayim the way you were misusing them before. And then, now, Lamed Aleph 35, it says, you threw me after your body. This is an important pasuk, which I want to tell you how it's used in Chazal. This phrase of being thrown after your body, this is not the only place it appears. It appears in several other places. The Gemara tells us that, talking about a man, that if a man eats a meal before he davens shacharis in the morning, the Gemara says about that person, the pasuk says, "Vaosi hishlachta acharei geveich," and me you threw after your body. Almost the same as it says it over here. To go and eat a meal before you daven means that you're taking care of yourself before you, so to speak, take care of me. You're putting your own needs before mine. For women, it's not the same. It's not the same requirement, because a woman's chiyuv to daven is not time bound, even though she has to daven if she doesn't have small children. But it's not the same requirement of doing it by a certain time, etc. But for a man, there is an isser. There is a prohibition against eating before davening. Now, just to fill in the halacha, the rule is that if he will not be able to daven properly without something to eat, then he's allowed to eat or drink before davening, like a cup of coffee. Mm-hmm. That would be permitted. Now, the reason for that is because that eating is not for himself. That eating is in order to be able to daven. So the eating is ultimately for the purpose of davening. So then that is okay. But when a person eats because they want to eat, then it becomes inappropriate, because then it's putting their own selves before HaKadosh Baruch Hu.
No question. Because let's say you don't eat before you go to shul on Shabbos, right, to daven. And then you're davening really through the whole morning. But you're not allowed to fast on Shabbos either. Like,
right. Till Chatzos, till half the day. You can't fast. So today, right now, Chatzos is about 12:30. So usually the Kiddush starts well before that.
Last week was at the Bar Mitzvah.
Okay, so Kiddush...
Yeah, that was...
Kiddush is... Now, the truth is, I don't want to get sidetracked into the halacha over here, but you should just be aware that there is somewhat of a challenge in America. See, this whole notion of Shabbos davening being at depending on where you live, 8:30, 9 o'clock, that's a very American thing. You know, if you go to Eretz Yisrael, it's unheard of.
Right? Yeah,
you're in Cholent at 9 o'clock.
Oh, yeah. They Cholent in the morning?
No, they finish davening by 9:30. Davening on Shabbos is a 7 o'clock affair, 7:30.
You get up early to pray to God on Shabbos. You get up early to pray to God.
So the women were never really involved too much with that
then. Yeah, well, in Europe, they used to, it was very common practice for people to come to learn starting around 3 o'clock in the morning on Shabbos morning. They would come to learn, and then they would daven very, very early and go home and eat their meal.
At 3 in the morning, do we get
to get? To learn. You can't it's too early to daven. But they would start learning then, and learn until morning, and then at first light they would daven shacharis, and they would be home already by 10 o'clock, probably by 9 o'clock they'd be home already. And they would eat their first meal. You know, there was already...
So women were never or expected to daven with a group in
right.
the American fashion.
It's a very American thing. The whole idea... See, what has happened in America, which was not the case in Europe, is that in America, the shul has become the social focal point. Mm-hmm. That's a very big change from the past. The shul was never the social focal point of the community. It was the place that people came to learn or daven, and it was almost always men. Women would come, but there was never this sense of it being a social gathering. It wasn't meant to be that way. Women socialized in other venues, not shul. That wasn't where it was. That wasn't like the place. In America, because we don't have a shtetl anymore, so there's very little that we get together for other than shul. So shul has become the focal point.
And if we didn't have shul, we
would have no focal point.
Nobody, I don't know, a lot of people would daven or
right.
learn how to daven.
Right. No, so these days, shul has become a much more a crucial institution.
It's kind of like an ingathering
right.
of the Jewish people.
It's the place where we gather to daven and to learn and to socialize and to hear speakers mm-hmm. and to do kiruv and everything.
To take care of our kids.
Everything. The shul. Everything revolves around the shul.
Right.
That's in America. That was not the case in Europe. We have to understand it's a very new phenomenon. When I speak on the subject of feminism and how it fits in to Yiddishkeit, one of the things I try to explain is that because the one of the big things that feminism tends to push is women's involvement in the shul and the exclusion of women from services, etc. We have to understand it's a very, very recent quote unquote problem. Because in Europe, it was irrelevant. No woman felt like she was being left out because she couldn't daven for the Amid or couldn't lane or get an aliyah. Because either she wasn't there or if she was there, it wasn't like a big deal. That was the men thing that they did. It wasn't something. It only became that way because of America. Because the shul has become such a focal point. So then women can say, well, I feel like I'm left out because I'm not involved in what the focal point is. That this is a very new phenomenon. So, the the whole system that we have has led to this problem. This is what you brought up about eating, because a man now faces a very big dilemma when he gets up in the morning on Shabbos. If he's going to an 8:30 or 9 o'clock minyan, forget fasting till midday, which is already a problem. But you can solve that by just taking a drink of water. You can always take a drink of water before davening, that's for sure. Man can do that. That's not considered putting his body before God. A drink of water is nothing. And that does solve the problem of not fasting. But what happens is a man gets up and he's going to go to a 9 o'clock minyan. And, you know, I grew up going to a 9 o'clock minyan in Philadelphia. So it's 8:30 in the morning, I'm going to leave for shul. Now, I know that I'm going to go to shul and I'm not going to have kiddush till 12.
Yeah.
Right now at 8:30 in the morning, I'm not hungry. I could daven very well. I could have kavana. I'll be fine. But the reason why I'm hungry is because I know I'm not eating till 12. That's why I'm hungry. Right. But that's not really the reason that justifies eating. What justifies eating is that I'll be able to daven. But I could daven. I have no problem davening right now. It's that I'm anticipating that down the line I'm going to start getting hungry. So it does cause a real problem because it doesn't exactly fit the halacha. And so you know, it's a it's a dilemma. It's a dilemma. So if a man has that issue, so they are allowed to eat. It becomes challenging because you're allowed to eat to make sure that you're not hungry down the line.
And you don't lose your focus.
And you don't lose your focus. Yeah, but the question is what to eat.
You're not gonna eat a meal though.
Right. Yeah. You can't have a meal, yeah. And also. You know, a person shouldn't indulge. Like the Mishnah Berurah writes, you can have a cup of coffee, but don't put sugar in the coffee. Because the sugar is for me. That's not for God. Right? The coffee.
Can we just give you more energy?
Okay. No, that could be. What if I can't drink coffee without sugar? Then I need it in order to be able to drink. Right. But the person, it's very hard. A person has to keep in mind they're only eating or drinking so that they can daven. I'm talking about a man, and that's a very hard thing to do. Because once you're starting to eat, you have a piece of cake, and you have a donut, you know, it's Shabbos morning, you know.
How does orange juice fit into that? And I'm serious, just because I deal with the challenge all the time. Do I take that little small drink of orange juice before I go or not?
For a woman, it's not a problem. It's only for a man.
Yeah. I don't have children at home anymore. I mean, I have one daughter there.
But you're still, you are obligated to daven, but you don't have the same restrictions about when to daven and what to do first, what to do second, all of that. Yeah. Not the same thing.
So don't women have a natural yen to pray on their own directly with God instead of with a minion in the whole synagogue? And does one feel guilty if they do that?
There's nothing wrong with women davening. Mm-hmm. In Europe, that was the way. Women daven on their own. Oh, women daven.
I am drawn to daven by myself.
You're certainly committed to do it.
I challenge by it constantly, is that I'm not coming over. And I have a steeple. I have a little stender on a porch, and it's gorgeous right there.
You're perfectly in your right to do that. You want to come to shul because you don't want to be outside. If you don't come to shul, then you're not part of the community. Mm-hmm. So the fact is that the shul is the focal point, and therefore people should come to shul to be part of the community.
So you can daven at home and come for finish.
You can do that. There's nothing wrong with it. For a woman. For a man, that's a problem.
No, but that's socially making a
problem. So for a woman, ideally not supposed to eat, but she could.
No, a woman is fine. She can eat. Okay. A woman
can eat.
Yeah.
Not
on the woman
at all.
Well, now
Kiddush.
No, so Kiddush. Kiddush, okay, we're going
to
get
it. Kiddush.
You wanted to be done, right? Yeah, some of them. Kiddush works like this. Kiddush, you're only obligated in Kiddush. We spoke about this in the summer. You're only obligated in Kiddush once you daven Shacharis. Mm-hmm. Before you daven Shacharis, you're not obligated in Kiddush.
So,
yeah. Sure.
Really?
Now,
before or after Brachos?
Now, wait. That's for a woman who davens Shacharis. If a woman daven shachris, which means you don't have small children, so you're davening a regular shachris, then you become obligated in Kiddush, and also a man becomes obligated in Kiddush, after davening Shmona Esrei of shachris. So if you want to eat after shachris, before Priyas HaTorah, before Musaf, you have to have Kiddush. But if you eat before that point, then you're allowed to eat whatever you want. No problem. Now, if a woman has small children, and therefore she's not davening shachris, so what is she davening? She's davening, usually women say brachos in that sort of situation. So then whatever she normally davens, that will obligate her in Kiddush. So if she says brachos, she will then have to now have Kiddush. So we had this last week. My wife realized last week that the grape juice was affecting my seventh month old, who's still nursing. And when she would nurse after my wife has grape juice, then she would have trouble settling down for a nap. So my wife stopped having grape juice, which is no problem, so I make Kiddush for her. What happens on Shabbos morning? So Shabbos morning, she can't make Kiddush on grape juice because that'll affect the baby. But on the other hand, she wants to eat. So in the past, what we've done is she's made Kiddush on apple juice, which is acceptable on Shabbos morning. But we didn't have any apple juice last week. So she told me, what should I do?
Go to your neighbor.
Yeah, she could have done that. So I told her, don't daven. Then what she would normally do, she usually says brachos. I said, don't say brachos until right before I come home from shul. And then you can eat until you say brachos. Because until you say brachos, you're not chayav in Kiddush yet. Kiddush is only obligatory after shacharis, whatever that the definition of shacharis is for you.
I always thought that I should say brachos on Shabbos before I eat something.
Well, yeah. Do you daven Shmona Esrei?
Yeah.
Well, if you daven Shabbos, it's fine. Yeah. That's okay. Because you're not obligated to Kiddush until after
you. I thought you had to say brachos.
It's a nice thing to do. It's a nice thing to do.
You're about to say brachos, but you didn't say brachos.
It's a nice thing to do brachos first. It's a nice thing anyway, just to start your day with that. It's a good thing to do.
Say shacharit. Is it just the Amida, or is it all of shacharit? That a woman who doesn't have little kids is obligated?
The Amida. Well, you mean, what is she obligated to do besides that?
I'll tell you, for me, like, all I do is, like, the bracha, Shema, and then the Midah. I don't do Shachari.
That's fine.
I do
that's
a bridge.
Fine. That's fine. If you have time.
If
you have,
what? You don't do
it. Because it's Zimra, right.
But when you say Shema, do you say the brachos before and after Shema?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, that's fine. Yeah, that's fine.
I see the first paragraph.
That's fine.
I'm a flip.
Can you, I mean, just if you want to, sorry, say Shema in the morning, are you allowed to say just the first paragraph, or are you, when you say Shema, you have to say all?
It's better to say all three.
Yeah.
It's better to say all three. But you don't have the same obligation. A man has to say all three.
Right.
You don't have that same obligation. But it's better to say all three. You don't have to if you want to say one.
But if you're running late during the week, can you just say the first two lines of Shema?
Who is running
late? I mean, can I say just the first two lines of Shema, and then when I come into the chakras, say it then, the whole thing? And also, I make the time. I have a business, and many times I'm called early. So I try to say Shema the first two lines, just not the whole paragraph,
okay,
so that when I daven, then I say the whole thing. Or should I say the whole paragraph?
If you have no time, you'll do it later. It's okay.
But would I say the first paragraph and still repeat that first paragraph?
Yeah, when you regularly daven, then say the whole thing.
Again?
Yeah.
Oh, I think it was the author of Rich Shalev that came here last year,
yeah.
And I think he is the one that said for a woman with davening that she can just say the two lines of Shema, and she's fine.
Yeah,
because it isn't a tefillah.
Right.
It's just.
It's true. No, that's true. A woman could say just the first two lines of Shema. Officially, a woman doesn't have to say any of
right.
Shema. As much as you can do is good. The main thing you have to do is Shema Esrei. That's the main thing. It's best to say Shema also.
Once you become into a business, as we don't have children, still young children at home, are we obligated like a man?
Not like a man, but you are obligated to daven Shemona Esrei at Shacharis and Mincha. Those are the two things that you have to do.